Okay, great. All right. So the previous speakers, including Molly and Tom earlier in the day, have introduced a lot of the topics that I'm going to be showing. And so a couple of the figures will actually be repeats because they're kind of the basic background. But I'll go over them briefly just in case anyone was not at one of those talks. But we'll be continuing on some of the same themes. We're interested in trying to understand how the neurotransmitter dopamine contributes to psychiatric disorders and how the dopaminergic drugs that are commonly used in treating those disorders influence behavior, influence symptoms, and influence decision-making. And so that's understanding the role of dopamine in decision-making is important not only for understanding the normal functions of dopamine, but it's also important because there are, at this point, tens of millions of people worldwide who are taking dopaminergic medications, and it's not exactly clear what the effects of those drugs are on behavior. So those would be people that have schizophrenia or attention deficit disorder or Parkinson's disease, or in some cases depression. And so it would be really important for us to understand better what the role of dopamine in learning and decision making is. Okay, so this is one very simplified framework for how we could think about value-based decision-making, which Tom spoke about earlier in the workshop. And so say we're faced with a situation where someone presents us with two glasses of juice, and one's like orange juice, and one is some slightly strange green vegetable juice. Okay. All right, so then we could think about assigning values to those two different options. And then we compare those values, and then we make a choice based on those values. And let's just suppose, just so we can see what happens, that you choose the strange green vegetable juice. Okay, and then at the time that you taste that juice, you can evaluate that the outcome that you've received relative to the expectations that you had. And you can use that the signal at that time, that signal to learn about what has just happened. So if the vegetable juice is actually surprisingly good, it's better than you thought it would be, then actually you might want to increase your value estimate for that option, and then you should be more likely to choose it again in the future. Okay, so it's not clear what role emotions play in all of this, and I won't talk much about it here, but some of my research work, my recent work has been on predicting subjective feelings using computational models, which may be useful for understanding the symptoms of psychiatric disorders or mood disorders, but that's a talk for another day. So for now, for this talk, I'm going to talk about the role of dopamine in decision-making. Okay, so the vast majority of the dopamine neurons in the brain are in these adjacent areas in the midbrain, the substantia nigra and the ventral tegmental area. And these neurons project widely throughout the brain, particularly to the striatum and the frontal cortex. And early research suggested that dopamine might be involved in representing rewards, so the rewards that an animal has received. And so in these classic studies by Olds and Milner in the 50s, what they showed was that they could implant an electrode in certain areas of a rat's brain, and when the rat presses a lever, so here's a rat here in the box, presses a lever, and then it gets a brief electrical impulse on that electrode. And if you do that for certain areas, the animal will press the lever basically continuously, so to the point of not eating anymore. And an area, the most effective area in these studies to place your electrode is the medial forebrain bundle, which is this descending myelinated bundle of fibers that projects to the dopamine neurons in the VTA. So when you stimulate that fiber bundle, you get a release of dopamine into the nucleus accumbens, which is a subregion of the striatum. So if you use dopaminergic drugs to block the certain dopamine receptors in the striatum, then you need a larger current on the electrode to get the animal to press the same number of times. And alternatively, if you give the animal a drug like cocaine, which might prolong the influence of dopamine, then you need a smaller smaller current to get the same number of presses. So one simple explanation for those findings is that the dopamine release is actually rewarding. Okay, so that for a couple of decades, No one seemed to have any real problems with that. And then in the, oh right, I forgot to mention that also consistent with that kind of view is the fact that this pathway is really closely involved in a lot of what we know about addiction. And so, for example, the VTA dopamine neurons have nicotinic and opioid receptors, and it's thought that that this system is heavily involved in a lot of the addiction that we see. So that's kind of consistent with this idea that dopamine release might be rewarding. Okay, so that was fine for a while, and then these results were published in the 90s. Tom mentioned them briefly before, but I'm going to go over them just to make sure everyone's on the same page here. So these were recordings from the dopamine neurons in awake primates done by Wolfram Schultz. And what he found was that when an animal received an unexpected juice reward, there was an increase in dopamine activity for this, what's called a positive prediction error. And at this point, you should be very familiar with this concept of reward prediction error being the difference between what you got and what you expected to get. Okay, so a positive prediction error leads to a burst of dopaminergic activity. But if you have a cue like a tone or a light that reliably predicts the receipt of that juice reward, the activity moves to the time of the cue, and there's no change in activity at the time of the fully anticipated juice reward. And finally, if on some trials you omit the juice reward, there is a reduction in activity for this negative prediction error. So in a typical reinforcement learning model, much like ones that you've already seen, the value V of T for, say, the cue, like the tone or the light, is updated on each trial, but based on the reward prediction error times the learning rate, which determines how fast the animal adjusts their expectations. And so if you get more than you expected, next time you should expect more, and if you get less than you expected, next time you should expect less. And because those value estimates could be used to guide decision-making, through experience, we should get better and better at making decisions. So those experiments were done in primates, but there's more recently been some results from human patients with some rare recordings of dopamine neurons in Parkinson's patients. So Parkinson's disease is characterized by a loss of dopamine neurons, but there are still about 20% of dopamine neurons in a lot of the patients, and in some patients that are where the medications have stopped working, those are good candidates for deep brain stimulation surgery, which at this point have been done in around 50,000 or so patients worldwide. And so it's quite a reliable surgery and as safe as brain surgery could be at this point, I guess. So this is kind of what it looks like. You drill a hole in the top of the head, and then you lower these electrodes that are there permanently. And because the target for those operations is the subthalamic nucleus, which is pretty close to the substantia nigra, what the neurosurgeons can do in some cases is to lower the electrodes a little bit farther and record dopamine neurons for 10 or 15 minutes. And they do this while the patients are awake, because to determine the location of the DBS electrodes, they also have to have the patients awake so they can observe the effects on their motor symptoms. So the subject is awake, and they're recording from dopamine neurons, and they can do this for about just 10 or 15 minutes, but that's enough time to let them do a little short experiment where they can win and lose expected and unexpected little prizes. And so what they found was that the dopamine neurons increase their activity in response to unexpected gains in a little game and decrease their activity for unexpected losses. But when we break it down by large and small negative prediction errors and large and small positive prediction errors, you can see there's a big difference for positive prediction errors, but there doesn't seem to be much difference in activity for the negative prediction errors. And that's actually consistent with what some researchers have suggested, that dopamine neurons might not represent these negative outcomes in the same way as they represent the positive surprises. So one thing we might want to know is, well, what's happening downstream? So this is at the level of the dopamine neurons, but downstream, where the values presumably are being updated, we might want to know what is the dopamine concentration in that area. So that's something that we can do in rodents. And this is an experiment I did at the University of Washington. And what we did was we used a technique called cyclic voltammetry. So this is a collaboration with Paul Phillips and a grad student that was working in the lab, Andy Hart. And what Andy and I did was to implant carbon fiber electrodes bilaterally in the nucleus accumbens of these rodents. And then we could use this technique called cyclic voltammetry to measure the dopamine levels while the animals were doing a simple probabilistic reward task. And in that task, the animals would press one of two levers, and one lever had a 75% chance of leading to four pellets and otherwise led to one pellet, and the other lever had a 25% probability of leading to four pellets and otherwise led to one pellet. And so what's shown here is the four possible outcomes. And what you can see is that when the animal gets that first pellet, when they get their outcome, there's always this small this increase in dopamine for all of the outcomes. And that quickly comes back down to baseline, and then the dopamine concentration differentiates by what the reward was and what the expectation was. And so this gray line at the top here is when the animal had a 25% chance of getting four pellets, so that would be the biggest positive prediction error. And this red line here at the bottom is when the animal had only a 25% chance of getting one pellet, and they got one pellet, so that would be the biggest negative prediction error. And we can see that the dopamine concentrations at this time are nicely ordered by the prediction error and representing both positive and negative. Okay, so I mentioned before that these signals are thought to be used to update value estimates. And those signals could be used to help us make better decisions. And we can test that hypothesis by looking at what happens when dopamine levels are different, say in different populations. And as I mentioned briefly, Parkinson's disease is characterized by a loss of dopamine neurons. So at the point of diagnosis, they've in general lost around 80% of those dopamine neurons. This is a slice through the midbrain of a Parkinsonian patient and a normal or healthy, or at least until whatever happened that led to this, normal person, similar age, I would hope. And what you can see here is the staining that is the neuromelanin that's deposited by the dopamine neurons. So this is a healthy looking substantia nigra, and that's where the name came from. But if you look at this Parkinsonian patient, you see that this staining is missing. There's no neuromelanin pigment there. Okay, and that has to do with the fact that most of their dopamine neurons have been lost. And in 1957, Arvid Carlson did quite a famous experiment where he gave rabbits a drug that depleted catecholamine levels, which includes dopamine is a catecholamine, and that rendered the animals catatonic. And then he did a very simple manipulation, gave them an injection of levodopa, L-dopa, which is the precursor to dopamine, and waited 15 minutes, and the rabbits were back to normal. So in 2000, Carlson won the Nobel Prize, or shared the Nobel Prize for the discoveries, including this one that related to identifying that dopamine was a neurotransmitter. And L-dopa is actually still the main treatment for Parkinson's disease. So it's taken by 10 million people worldwide. And it does improve the motor symptoms in most of the patients. Okay, so experiments in animals suggest that dopamine neurons represent reward prediction errors that can be used for learning about values and guiding decision making. And you can do pharmacology experiments in Parkinson's patients. They're already taking these dopaminergic drugs to treat their disorder. And so it's a natural place to start to look to see how dopamine drugs affect learning and decision making. So this is a study that was done by Michael Frank, and what he did was there were two phases of the task, and there are three of these pairs of symbols. And in each, the subjects were presented with a pair of symbols and asked to choose whichever one they wanted, and they received positive feedback if they had chosen the correct one. And so one of these symbols is associated with an 80% probability of positive feedback and a 20% probability of negative feedback, and the other one is the opposite. And so the subjects were trained until they could tell which one of the symbols were the better ones. And they could do this task in two kind of different ways. So one way would be to figure out which symbol is the better symbol, the one you should choose. And another way to think about it is which is the worst symbol, which is the one that you should avoid, because in each of these pairs they're always presented with the same two symbols. So then that was the training phase, and then they went to a transfer phase, a performance phase, where they were given all the different possible combinations of the characters and asked to choose which one they wanted and to try to maximize reward. And they didn't get any feedback at this point. So they had to have learned what the different values were for those options in order to do this part correctly. Okay, so what's plotted here in black is the performance of the healthy control subjects, and this is the probability that they choose the best possible symbol when it's one of the options in the pair. And this is the percent of the time that they avoided the worst possible symbol when it's one of the symbols in the pair. And you can see that they're at about 70% performance for both of those cases. Now, if you look at the patients off dopamine medication, we can see that those patients are actually better at learning to avoid the worst possible stimulus, and they're basically the same as the controls for the better stimulus. And we can see that when we look in green at the patients on medication, we see the opposite. So one interpretation is that the loss of dopamine neurons in Parkinson's disease increases learning to avoid the bad stimuli, and the dopamine drugs then increase the learning to choose the good stimuli. And so that suggests that dopamine does play a role in learning, but it doesn't test whether that role is actually the one that's predicted by computational models. And so an experiment that I did during my PhD with Paul Glimcher at NYU, we tested one simple prediction of those reinforcement learning models, and we did that in Parkinson's patients on and off dopamine medication. And what we did was we had them choose between red and green targets, which would change, where sometimes the red target was the better one and sometimes the green target was better. So what you can see here is the choices that this patient is making. And in the first block, the red target has three times the probability of reward, and they tend to choose it a bit more often. And after about 80 trials, probability is reversed. Now the green target is better, and they adjust their choices. And you can see that they're basically tracking the reward probabilities, adjusting their choices according to the current reward rates. Now, in gray is the model fit, and this is a very simple model that you've seen before, where there's just a learning rate parameter on the reward prediction error term. And so if dopamine is actually representing this reward prediction error term, then an increase in the dopamine release would have the same effect on behavior as an increase in the learning rate. And so that's exactly the prediction we would make, that learning rate should be higher in patients on medication than off, and that's exactly what we see here. The patients on medication, these are the exact same patients, their learning rates are higher when they're on dopamine medication. So this is another study that was mentioned by Tom in his talk earlier, done by Mattias Pisciglione here at UCL. And what he found was that in these gain trials where subjects try to figure out which symbol to choose to get a reward or to find the symbol that has an 80% chance of leading to reward, as opposed to getting nothing, the subjects could quickly figure out which symbol that was. And when they were on L-DOPA, they were even more likely to choose that rewarding symbol. And when dopamine transmission was disrupted with haloperidol, which blocks D2 receptors, that tendency was reduced. Now, interestingly, the subjects also faced loss trials. And in those trials, the subjects tried to figure out which symbol to avoid, much like the task I mentioned earlier from Michael Frank. And so that symbol, there's a symbol with an 80% chance of leading to a loss, and otherwise they got nothing. So there's no potential rewards in that case. And subjects pretty quickly learned to avoid that symbol, and there was no effect of the dopamine drugs on how they learned about in that loss frame. So these studies all suggest that dopamine drugs affect learning, but there's also some evidence that dopamine drugs can play a role in performance outside of learning. And this is a study that was also done at UCL by Tamara Shiner, and she repeated the experiment that Michael Frank had done with testing subjects on dopamine medication and off dopamine medication, and she could see that the percent correct, the success rate was higher when the subjects were on their medication. Okay, but then she added a third group of subjects, and that group was trained off dopamine medication and then tested in the transfer phase where all the symbols are jumbled up with no feedback. They're tested on that phase on dopamine medication. And what she found was that the performance of those patients was the same as the ones that were trained and tested on medication. And so that suggests that while dopamine may play a role in learning, it also may play a role that's outside of learning because the subjects achieve the same level of performance whether or not they were trained on or off dopamine medication. So there have been a number of other reports that have suggested that dopamine drugs might increase risk-taking. One really prominent example of that is that a small fraction of Parkinson's patients actually develop pathological gambling after they start taking their dopaminergic drugs. In some cases, they've lost hundreds of thousands of dollars. There's been lawsuits against the drug companies. So even though that's uncommon, it does suggest that there's something about these drugs that is affecting risk-taking. And one possibility is that that happens through a learning-related mechanism. So they learn differently about the things in their environment, and that makes them take more risks. But another possibility is the dopamine actually plays a role during the decision itself, so when the subjects are actually making decisions. And so that's something that I wanted to test in the lab. And so this is an experiment that I did with Ray Dolan, Peter Dian, and Nicolina Scandale, who was a master's student with me and is now a PhD student at Cambridge. And what we did was we had subjects come into the lab. We tested them in two different sessions, one on placebo and one on L-DOPA. It was double-blind setup. And they did 300 trials in each case. And on each of these trials, they faced a choice between a safe option, in this case, 0 pounds, or a risky option, in this case, flipping a coin to possibly win 65p or lose 36p. In this case, the subject decides to gamble, and after a brief delay, they find out that they won. Okay. And there are actually three different types of trials. So these are the mixed trials. They have potential gains and losses. Then there's some gain trials, so that's kind of like in the Pastiglione experiment. There's trials where they can't lose anything. So they make a choice between a certain gain and a gamble where they can win a larger amount of money or get zero. And then there's also the loss trials. So the opposite, they can't win anything in those trials. They face a choice between a certain loss and a gamble where they might lose an even larger amount. And what you can see here is that the subjects on both placebo and L-DOPA tend to choose the gain trials, the gain gambles most of the time, and they tend to choose the loss gambles less, and they're kind of intermediate for the mixed trials. Although those fractions should depend on the exact design matrix that's used, so it's hard to interpret anything from just that result. But what we're really interested in is in these exact same subjects, do they take more gambles on L-DOPA or placebo? And what we found is that in the mix and loss trials with potential losses, there is no change in gambling, and if anything, there's a slight reduction. But in the gain trials, there is a significant increase in how many gambles they take. So that's consistent with a lot of these other studies in learning environments, or in this pathological gambling case, where risk-taking is actually being increased by dopaminergic drugs. Okay, so if the L-DOPA is actually what is responsible for increasing the risk-taking in the gain trials, then much like what Molly showed, you might expect to see a dose dependency to that effect. And so you might expect that the subjects that have the lowest body weights and therefore the largest effective doses would have the biggest increase in their risk-taking, and that's exactly what we see. Okay, so there's quite a significant relationship between the increase in risk-taking and the effective dosage. Okay, so now we want to understand what exactly is going on here. What exactly is dopamine doing in this? And we can do that by applying computational models. And so a standard model that you could use is one that's based on the prospect theory model from economics. And so we can fit a parametric version of that theory in which there's a subjective value function that relates to the objective rewards, so those actual numbers, to the utilities or subjective values that explain the choices the subject makes. And so this parameter lambda is related to loss aversion, and the fact that it's greater than 1 suggests that subjects are somewhat loss averse in this task. And then there's two other parameters, alpha gain and alpha loss, which correspond to the curvature in the utility function in the gain domain or in the loss domain. And actually, it's pretty close to 1 there, so there doesn't seem to be a lot of curvature. But what we might expect is that one way that you could get an increase in risk-taking in the gain trials is by increasing the alpha gain parameter for those potential rewards. And so we might expect to see an increase in the alpha-gain parameter on subjects in subjects on L-DOPA, but we see over here in this plot of the differences that there's no change in that parameter. So it doesn't seem that this parametric model can actually account for the effect we see, this increased risk-taking in the gain trials. So to understand why this might be the case, we need to understand the data a little bit better. So what's plotted here is a relationship between the probability of gambling and the attractiveness of the gamble. So for each certain gain amount, we systematically modulated the larger potential reward of the gamble. And the larger that amount, the more likely a subject should be to choose the gamble. And that's exactly what we see here. As the gamble gets more attractive, they choose it more often. But what you can see here is the placebo data is in blue and the L-DOPA in red, and you can see that at all levels of gamble attractiveness, there's this small increase in the subject's tendency to take the extra risk. And what's plotted over here is the model fit for the parametric prospect theory model, and that model, at least the way the kind of standard way to fit it, there's no difference in that model in the two cases. So it can't account for this difference that we see here. So we propose a new model, and I can go into more detail about the math if anyone's interested in the questions. But the basic idea is that we add an additional tendency to approach or avoid gambles that is independent of value. So when this parameter is positive, the probability that even the most unattractive gambles will sometimes be chosen is significantly greater than zero. And that allows the model to capture the increase in gambling that we see here, even for these really unattractive gambles that subjects should never be choosing. And we could think of this, some people would talk about this as maybe a Pavlovian influence, so tendency to approach those bigger potential rewards. So here's the results of the full model fit. So these beta gain parameters are the Pavlovian approach for gains. Beta loss is the Pavlovian avoidance for loss. Or these don't have to be approach and avoidance. They could go either way, positive or negative. But the way it turns out is that subjects in both sessions have a tendency to gamble in the gain domain more than the value itself would say. And in the loss domain, they also have a tendency to avoid gambles. Even the most attractive gambles are ever presented, they still have some tendency not to choose them. So what we can see here is that when we take the differences between the L-DOPA and placebo sessions, we see there is a significant difference, a significant increase in the beta gain parameter in the subjects on L-DOPA. Okay, so just like we did before, if this model is really explaining the change in behavior that we see, we should see a dose dependency to that effect. And that's exactly what we see here. The subjects with the larger effective doses also have bigger increases in this beta gain Pavlovian approach parameter. All right, so we've suggested that there's a role that dopamine plays in decision making, which doesn't seem to depend on learning. And we also want to see, so it's well known that aging is associated with a gradual decline in the dopamine system. And so one question we might ask is whether that aging-related decline in dopamine is related or has an effect that's consistent with what we see here when we boost dopamine levels. So this image shows dopamine D2 receptor densities in a young subject and an elderly subject, and you can see there's greatly reduced levels throughout the brain, and that can be shown. This is an image from PET, and that can be shown for also D1 receptor densities and dopamine transporter densities. And that reduction is estimated around 5 to 10% per year. And it starts actually at a fairly young age. So there have been a number of studies that have suggested that older subjects make choices in these decision-making under uncertainty tasks in a different way, and they may be more risk-averse in many paradigms. But it's not really known whether that change in risk preferences relates in any way to this change in the dopamine system. And so to address this question, we turn to data from a smartphone app. Okay, so some of you have probably heard of this. If you hadn't, you can download it in the Apple Store or the Android Store. It's called the Great Brain Experiment. I developed it with several other researchers at UCL, and now There are 8 different games that people can play. They're all based on research that's happening at UCL in neuroscience. And the initial release had 4 different games that tested working memory, impulsivity, visual perception, and then there was a game called What Makes Me Happy, based on the laboratory research that I've done, closely related to what I was just showing you, and where subjects make choices about whether to gamble or not, and then they also indicate how they feel throughout the game. So at this point, there are thousands of people that have downloaded the app throughout the world, and this is just the location of a few hundred of those players. Okay, so in the What Makes Me Happy game, the subjects face this choice between a safe option and a risky option, just like in the lab experiment I showed you before. So in this case, that would be taking 55 points for sure, or spinning a spinner to try to win 85 points. So they start out with 500 points. They're just trying to win as many points as they can. And in this case, the subject, this player, anonymous player somewhere in the world, decides to gamble, and they get lucky and they win 85 points. Okay, and then every few trials, they're asked how happy they are, and presumably if they win a lot, then their happiness will go up. And so each play is only 5 minutes long, so that was an important feature of this this experiment. All these games are 2 to 5 minutes because we didn't think that people would really want to do our laboratory experiments, or hour-long, hundreds and hundreds of trials. So we made it quite short, but it turned out that we could still get very useful data, partly because there were so many people that downloaded it and participated and contributed to our research. And so I'm not going to talk about it more here, but well, there's a paper you can look up that came out recently. And what we were able to do was to show that in this task, the happiness that subjects reported can be explained by their recent history of rewards and expectations using this relatively simple equation, which includes the expectations and reward prediction errors resulting from those expectations. And because, so we could predict the ongoing happiness ratings in thousands of players, and because these reward prediction errors, of course, are thought to be related to the phasic activity of dopamine neurons, one obvious possibility is that dopamine is in some way contributing to these feelings of happiness that people have, and we found some evidence to suggest that that is the case. Okay, but for now I'm just going to focus on the decision-making data from this task because we're interested in this question about how that changes over the lifespan. Okay, so I'm going to show some data from around 24,000 subjects making around 1.5 million decisions. This is the age distribution, so you can see, not surprisingly, there's a lot of young subjects in our sample, but we also see that even in the 60 to 69 group, we have around 900 subjects. So hopefully we have enough data to address this question. And so we're going to next plot the fraction of gambles that subjects take in each of the 3 types of trials, mixed trials, lost trials, and gain trials, as a function of age. Okay, so what's plotted here in orange is the gambling in the lost trials, and in green, the gambling in the mixed trials, and we can see that those are pretty stable over the lifespan. And if anything, maybe there's a slight increase in risk-taking in the mixed trials as subjects get older. But when we look at the gain trials, those are the same ones that L-DOPA increased risk-taking, we see that there's a steady, gradual decline in risk-taking across the lifespan. Okay, so one question is whether this change in economic preferences that we see here actually relates to the earnings that the subjects have, the points that the subjects win in this game. So how does their success in the game change over the lifespan? And what we can see here is that this is all relative to the number of points that subjects earn on average in the young group, the 18 to 24 group. What we can see is that in the lost trials and the mixed trials, there's no real change in earnings in those trials until perhaps the last age bin. So it seems like in those trials, subjects are earning basically just as much. But when we look at the gain trials, we see that there's a steady decline in how much subjects are earning in those trials. And so the older subjects are earning less, or they're getting fewer points on average than the younger subjects, and that's basically all accounted for by this reduced risk-taking in the GAIN trials. And that suggests that subjects, those older subjects are actually turning down, they're taking safe options instead of risky options that would on average earn them more points. Okay, so in the lab, we were able to show that a computational model could explain the effects of L-DOPA on decision-making. And so now we want to see whether that same computational model can explain the changes in this reduction in risk-taking over the lifespan. And it's the same trial type, so these GAIN trials are the same trials that are affected in both cases, and so we were hopeful that that the same parameter would fall out. And that's exactly what happened. So plotted over here, side by side, is the data from the lab. L-DOPA increases the beta gain approach parameter, the value-independent parameter. And we look in the smartphone data, we can see that there's a steady decline in the model parameter for approach towards potential gains. So to summarize, dopamine seems to represent a reward prediction error signal that can be used for learning about values, and those values can guide decision making. And using pharmacology experiments, we can show that dopamine plays a role in learning the values of actions. And these experiments have also revealed that dopamine may play different roles with respect to rewards and punishments, or gains and losses. That's something that there's a lot of ongoing research in that area. And dopamine may also play roles in decision-making that are independent of learning. And it seems that dopamine drugs and aging have opposite effects on risk-taking behavior, and both effects can be explained by increases and decreases in a Pavlovian approach towards a parameter that captures Pavlovian approach towards potential rewards in our computational model. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob. That was a fantastic talk, and I'm sure Professor Jonathan Flint will be very happy to see your sample size. Okay, so questions.
When people get older, they get wealthy.